Welcome to Our Common Nature, an exaltation of our living earth, an exploration of our niche within it, and an examination of the lasting solutions we will create by shifting our culture through care, wisdom, and working in community with the earth toward accordance with its way. In this space, we highlight place, building bridges, and finding solutions in the common ground on which we all stand. It is with gratitude and humility that we acknowledge that we are speaking, learning, and broadcasting from the ancestral homelands of the Mohican people, who are the indigenous peoples of this land. Despite tremendous hardship on being forced from here, today their community resides in Wisconsin and is known as the Stockbridge Munsee community. We pay honor and respect to their ancestors past and present as we commit to building a more inclusive and equitable space for all.
All right. Welcome back to Our Common Nature. Today we're joined by Stephen Fix from Fix Brothers Fruit Farm.
That's right.
Yep. Okay. And you, how would you describe yourself there? What's happening there? And you said you're fifth generation?
Fifth generation. I have an 11-year-old who's sixth generation. We were established in 1899. Started out as mostly cherry orchards back in the day. Had some cows running around. And then my grandfather and my great uncle pretty much opened this place up to buying more land, planting more trees, different commodities. And then my father and his brothers expanded it further. So now we are probably about as busy as I want to be. And we have, apples, cherries, peaches, pears, a few plums out there, and then try and keep it interesting during the fall with some pumpkins and sunflowers and whatever else, make it fun for that. But that's pretty much what I do. I mean, I've grown up doing every single job here. So pretty much manager, and as the herd thins in the Fix family here, it's, you know, throw a couple more hats on, people retiring, whatever, slow and taking a slower role.
Yeah. You said you're pruning right now. It's we're in end of February in 2024. That's normally what you'd be doing right now, is pruning the trees?
Well, yeah, that's pretty much the most consistent job. If we have rain or snow, or you're just exhausted from pruning. You know, my uncle and cousin, they spend most of their time in the shop fixing equipment, keeping everything going through the winter. And I myself, besides pruning, I have a lot to do in the packing house and around the coolers, because I still have apples in the cooler right now.
Yeah. That's from last year's harvest.
Last year's harvest, yeah. Mostly cider apples, because we got froze out last year pretty bad. So pretty much most of my Galas and Evercrisp are in there just sitting waiting to go to cider, some Fujis.
When you say froze out, how do you mean?
So in the spring, that's pretty much when you're most susceptible to get a freeze. You know, if you have your own garden, you know that if you put stuff in the ground too early, there's always that chance where it can dip down into the 20s. And this year was kind of odd, because the fruit was at a size where, you know, normally if you have a freeze when they're floral still, which is kind of normal, or, you know, more expected, it'll leave a minor little frost ring or something. But since the fruit was already 20 plus millimeters big, it pretty much just killed it, made it look like pumpkin stripes going down it. So it was just I don't care how much you like apples, I wouldn't even eat these things. So we had to watch them grow all year like that, knowing that they were just trying to get the best cider price we could.
Yeah. And so cider is basically what you've got left that you can do with them when they're, I guess they all kind of, you wouldn't say they're saleable, you know, for fresh eating because of that?
No. They were a lot of russet, which is like, you know, it just looks like rust on the outside of an apple skin. And yeah, there's no market for that. Even the secondhand market, where like they would go to like prisons or schools or, you know, cheapies, like down to the market, they were even unsaleable for that. And so that frost also killed most of my sweet cherry crop, and going back to last winter, froze out all my peaches. So that's where I'm standing here right now as I'm out pruning, just, you know, clicking the days off. I'm just sitting here thinking, I'm like, man, if it doesn't, you know, tighten up here a little bit to get us through like at least mid-March, the same possible thing could happen again. Like, say if it dipped down, you know, to zero and stayed there for a little bit, we wouldn't most likely have a stone fruit crop once again. So hitting on that climate change thing there, you know, like I said, it's background noise until, you know, pick your own's a big part of my operation as far as, you know, cash flow and people and word of mouth and, you know, the experience that people get to get from that. There's only so many years, you know, if it keeps going the way it's going, that I'm going to survive without growing peaches and cherries as the supplemental fruit before, you know, my main crop, which is apples, comes around.
Yeah. And this is what you're describing about the apples that you still have in your cooler. You're describing a situation that happens because we had a very late frost in 2023. That was around the end
after Mother's Day. Yeah, it was after Mother's Day for sure.
Yeah, which is, and we say that's part of climate change because here in New York, part of the issue that we're seeing with the changing climate is that the spring and fall are starting to be really erratic in the weather, meaning we don't have a gentle trend from, you know, winter temps into a mild to moderate spring into like a nice warm summer. It's kind of bouncing from summer to back to winter, back to, you know, somewhere in between, you know, from hour to hour almost in the months of April, you know, March, April, May these days, which for trees which have adapted to, you know, over centuries to a pretty stable more or less climate, and this is wreaking havoc because they can't adapt as fast to the, you know, none of humans can adapt to how quickly, you know, the weather is jumping, you know, 40 to 60 degrees from, you know, 8 hours. When kind of, I mean, you tell me, it seems like this is not something that you can really predict anymore.
No, it's definitely not. It's just, you know, it seems like that November, December is winter now. It seems to be the coldest 2 months of the year, and then January through March is just random. I mean, I don't even try and make sense of the weather. I just have to try and deal with it. But yeah, it's definitely, the trees aren't going to adapt in my lifetime to this for sure. So that's what I'm saying. If this is a trend, like what we're trending towards, then I got to figure something else out that's going to, you know, either be more hardy or, who knows? Like I said, the peaches got froze out last February because once again, it was like sort of this mild-ish winter, no snow cover. And it got down to 11 below temperature for, you know, 12, 13 hours. And the fact that we even had any crop at all on anything is crazy. But, you know, the stone fruit's really delicate when it comes to that. Like if it was a hard winter, if the trees shut off, you know, I gave them one last spray in the fall, and didn't want to do anything to them until I started pruning on them in May, and you got that cold weather, you got a chance. But when there's no ice on the ponds all winter, and, you know, all of a sudden it gets that cold, the tissues, there's, you know, the trees are alive. They're not shut down. They're not storing. They're pushing. Mm-hmm. So that cold stops them in its tracks.
You're kind of speaking to something that I wanted to bring up, wherein a lot of the fruit that we're used to growing here in the Northeast, they require what botanists call chill hours. So a certain amount of time annually with the temperature below freezing.
We call them degree days, but yeah, similar.
Yeah. So in order to facilitate a proper dormancy for the trees, right? And so are you finding that a lot of the species that we've kind of come to rely upon and know that we can grow here aren't getting the kind of chill hours that they need? That's what you mean by the fragility of the stone fruit?
Well, I mean, last year they definitely didn't. And, you know, it's not, it's all luck pretty much, you know? So I cannot complain. Before last year, I haven't had an issue with peaches in a while. I don't remember the last frost 2011-ish, maybe that era. But I've had a decade of solid peach crops now. Same thing with cherries, but cherries, they got to make it through the winter. Sweet cherries, I'm talking. Sour cherries are, I don't know, some sort of, I don't know what's in the strain that's different than sweet cherries, but the sour cherries are just, they're tough. They can hang. Mm-hmm. So even with sweet cherries, they got to make it through the winter. They got to make it through the spring, get pollinated. Hopefully you have, you know, some warm weather where the bees can get out there and do their thing. They have to set properly. And then, you know, a week before they're ready to pick, you can't have any rain or else they're all going to explode and your pick your own business is shot. So cherries around here, they're known as kind of like a heartbreaker. Like you can't insure them. It's too expensive to put insurance on, you know, what do I got? 25 acres of sweet cherries, maybe. So they're just sort of, you got to do all the stuff, prune them, spray them, take care, mow the grass, and just hope that you don't get the traditional 2 to 3 inches of rain at the end of June, like, you know, that likes to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Randomly, whenever it wants. So what are you doing then? You have to rethink what you're growing. Is that what the issue is? Or
I think, you know, me personally, it's so easy, you know, like I said, growing up doing this and just day in, day out, the days click off, you kind of get comfortable. It takes a certain conscious to actually look up from your everyday activities to strategize like a plan to convert your land into something more compatible with a climate that is just, you know, I don't know, that maybe as farmers you just live with. You know what I mean? So it's hard to, I think for our farm, for, you know, at least the relative near future, we're sticking with everything we have. But talking with my father, he just the other day, he was saying, you know, maybe try and figure something else that you would like to grow that could possibly make some money. He was throwing out grapes and stuff like that. I'm like, really, Dad? Like, I think we got time for grapes. But, you know, there's a discussion been started.
Yeah. And do you think that that's kind of where everyone needs to be regionally looking at is like what, I mean, obviously grapes take a lot more effort and extra work, but maybe strange fruits that we're not used to growing and selling, something like persimmons or even figs in some areas. Is there possibly like a future in that, or is that it seems like a daunting shift to go from?
It depends on what your goal is. So like for persimmons or figs, or I know you mentioned pawpaws one time, which was funny because I have a random trapper that comes here and brings me pawpaws. I think they all froze out last year too, because I just talked to him the other day. He said he didn't have any because he was going to bring me some seeds from whatever, how old his trees were to plant. But if you do stuff like that, I mean, I can't imagine you're going to have like a commercial wholesale market of them. I think that's probably more of like a specialty thing, like that you would, like mushrooms or something, like that you would bring to like a farmer's market or something like that, which, sure, you know, if you add everything up, I really don't know. It's fun to do, fun to get your name out there talking to the people, but bottom line, I don't know what that's doing for your bank account to keep the doors open. I really don't want to get involved with any like vegetable or ground crops, because that's going to require a whole new, you know, set of machinery and know-how and you know, stuff like that. But yeah, it depends on what your end game is for your operation. I think if anything, we would maybe try and consolidate a little bit of what we have, but like I said, our pick your own is very important to us. Apples is my main form of income for sure. Cause I commercially sell them.
Yeah. So paint us a picture. What's the farm kind of scope and scale like? It sounds you got quite a lot of acreage under production.
Under production, there's probably around 330-ish. There's probably 400 total, including woods and hedgerows and all that on houses. But yeah, I have my main farm and like two satellite farms that are within a couple miles of the farm.
Sure.
Try and keep everything close, because once you get into maintenance and spraying and picking and all that stuff, you kind of want to be close to the central storages and all that stuff. So
yeah, but that it seems like it would be a pretty big transition to move into, you know, something different that you haven't really done before, and to do so at a scale wholesale and large enough to kind of fit into your, you know, the kinds of sale operations that you have going.
Yeah, I mean, even with what we have going, I mean, stone fruit's not hard to sell. I mean, we can pretty much, if you have extra stone fruit that you throw in the woods, that's a great year because you've sold everything that can be sold, saturated the market. And especially in the Hudson Valley, I've noticed that, you know, when I go into ShopRite or something and I see sweet cherries in April, I'm like, all right, cherry season's coming. Cause you know, mm-hmm. you see them from Chile or whatever. And even it's all about shelf space as well. So it's, even though I do great with apples, there's only so many Honeycrisp I can grow, so many Galas I can grow.
Mm-hmm.
I think what I'm looking at is just trying to figure out my ceiling for, you know, the amount of bushels of apples or the amount of boxes of cherries or whatever that are going to be sold in this market. Cause you know, when the next thing comes out, they're done with cherries. When the next thing comes out, they're done with peaches. Mm-hmm. It's just the season of fresh fruit eating in the Hudson Valley.
I mean, things have been changing here in the Hudson Valley in a lot of ways, not just with the climate, but also somewhat demographically as well. Are you finding that you're meeting that change in some ways, or having to kind of rethink, not just kind of, and now you've mentioned you pick a couple of times. It seems like, is that a growing area for you?
I mean, COVID was ridiculous. So 2020, 2021, actually probably 2021, 2022, but it started in 2020. You talk about just like moving on the fly as far as reading a list of regulations that came out within a month, whether you can have your business open. If you were going to have your business open, this is what you got to do. So many people per acre. I mean, it was down to, you could have so many people per acre. And I'm like, well, you know, they're going to have to come count them. Like, how am I supposed to regulate that? So as far as like thinking on our feet and adapting to the volume of people, we can do that. We're not scared of that. The pick your own is the only place I pretty much feel demographic changing around here. This past year obviously wasn't as bad. I think it's going down a little bit as far as the amount of people here, but we just adapt. Like I said, the days just click off. We just do our thing, and you feel it more when there's not as many people. I feel.
So you're not really seeing a change in demand in what you know, at least from the large packing houses and stuff that you're selling to. But it has been the larger, would you say a larger turnout in the U-Pick over the years?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. I mean, word of mouth. So my mother started she's been sending out postcards, like literal, where she's got to print two-sided postcards to send to our mailing list customers. Now it's transitioning to like, you know, online, emails, website, trying to get away from the postcard thing. Cause you know, that's another, you know, $2,000-$3,000 to pick your own season for postcards we got to buy and send out. And I know people like getting the physical postcards. I'm old like that too. But yeah, trying to eliminate even little costs like that. But as far as, you know, even 5 years ago, 30-40% more people probably since 2018. Just word of mouth is crazy.
Yeah. Well, it's good. That's a good thing for farms and farming and for you guys on the farm. No, I guess to have such a turnout for that kind of event. But I guess that kind of puts you between a rock and a hard place when you have a rough crop loss, you know, from the changing climate or from, you know, random late frost. Are you seeing that there's like much you can do for that? Or are you kind of finding yourself in a readjusting kind of where you're thinking your money's going to come from with some of these, you know, larger questions?
It's kind of, I mean, I'm not worried about it yet. And like I said, it's like throwing a dart right now. What do you choose? What's gonna grow? How many years is it gonna take it to grow before you start making money on it? But you know, the people still know where I live, and they still know our phone numbers. And I gotta tell you, if this year for sweet cherries, we didn't open for pick your own. There was cherries there, but if we had our traditional opening day, these people drive, you know, some 3-4 hours. Like from New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts, everywhere. And, you know, if people get there 3:00 in the afternoon and I'm picked out, they're going to be upset. which I would be too, you know. I mean, opening day, you don't expect it, but I've been picked out on opening day where, you know, you send out the postcards, set up the tents, put out the signs, and that night you're taking everything down and sending the email and blocking the roads. And, you know, it's, like I said, it's always having too much of it, of a pick your own item is a good problem.
Sure. Yeah. But that's not everything. That's not your whole business. Doesn't just rest on pick your own. It sounds like you do a lot of larger, you know, wholesale sales or
I do a lot of, I sell a lot of wholesale, for stone fruit, a lot of volume in that, and apples, between pick your own and wholesale is still less than the commercial outfit of the apples, where, you know, we have a broker who gets us into all the big chain stores, and it's just tractor trailers every day sending out pack stuff.
Yeah. But I imagine your margins must be pretty, pretty slim, you know, considering the size of your operation and what it takes to kind of get to market with all of that.
Well, if you have a couple bad years in a row, you know, and the playing games with the insurance company, you can be in trouble for sure.
Yeah.
Like where you got to start like panic mode, you know. I mean, one thing about our farm, that's definitely been a positive as far as our existence is, you know, we've never taken loans out. Like we don't buy a new tractor unless we have the money for the tractor. We don't buy land unless we have the money for it, you know. So everything is kind of what happened to the dairy guys out there. I can't imagine having to go buy a $600,000 harvester and then, you know, either having no rain or too much rain or, you know, one bad year, you're finished. So yeah, that's where we're at. I mean, I think.
Do you feel like you're a professional gambler?
I don't gamble.
You don't have to.
I will lose every single time. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty much rolling the dice. The money you have invested. So, I mean, we just got some of the last checks for our fruit from 2023. And, you know, whatever we've got in the bank has to stretch until we start getting hopeful income from sweet cherries at the end of June. So there's a solid 5 months of, you know, no income. This year, we're going to get some relief with insurance money because they did total out a couple different blocks. But we got to wait till we can do the checks and balances where bushels in equals bushels out. And then you present that to the insurance company. So we'll have that this year. But I mean, yeah, you still have payroll every week. You still have the electric bills, all the other taxes, everything else that keeps, you know, just regular people living off of the farm's assets for, you know, 5 months. That's a long time of no income. So like I said, you have a couple, 2-3 bad years. Then you're in panic mode. Mm-hmm. It's not about growing stuff. It's probably about eliminating some stuff, you know, to try again next year. So
what do you do in panic mode? Do you kind of just sell some things off and see how it goes? Or
I gotta tell you, Seamus, I don't know if I want to see panic mode.
Fair enough.
But yeah, pretty much. I mean, you know, sell that 20 acres, sell that tractor, sell that mower, try and get, you know, a couple hundred grand.
Mm-hmm.
The local government's been kind of randomly helpful with assistance on that too. So
yeah, so that's a good question. Yeah, so where, as far as support or subsidy or just, you know, making sure the farmers can farm, you said the local government, but you know, the big body that you want to look to, I guess, is maybe the state, maybe even the Fed. Where are they at? How are they of any help?
They handed out loans to small businesses based on maybe what you've made the prior 2 years or whatever, and it wasn't even a loan. It was just like, you know, here's money, pay back whatever, 10% of it or whatever. Like if you borrowed $250,000, you got to pay them back $25,000.
These are the PPP loans that came out during COVID, or is this something?
That sounds right. Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, we're not going to say no to free money, especially from, you know, the feds there. So just keeping that and having it for payroll or something, you know, where it's just like there. There's other small programs for our migrant workers and tax credits on housing and stuff like that. But yeah, pretty much there. They leave you out there.
Yeah. And then they come and ask, like, you know, are you doing it safely and right and, you know, on time and et cetera. So is there a feeling of like being left to hang on one end and also a squeeze on the other with the regulations?
I don't want to talk about regulations. I've been doing so good. they are stifling, and they are just closing in around me. I can't, you know, this isn't a commercial, you know, big business owned farm. So it's like, when we're out there, well, like I said, I'm out there pruning trees today.
Yeah.
I should probably try and hire somebody to go do that so I can look at the, I have 4 audits this year, and there must be a lot of farmers out there doing very bad things, because I can't imagine where all of these rules and regulations came from. I can't imagine it. So, I mean, we have our global gap, which is a standard gap audit, that's accepted by pretty much every major retailer, excluding a few. That's a once a year, probably about $3,000, and a book about 4 inches thick full of compliances, risk assessments, water tests, all that stuff that, you know, we pay an auditor to come once a year. He might be there for half a day, looks around the farm, looks at the paperwork, and either nails me for something or doesn't, but, you know, gives me a chance to fix it. That's the global gap.
Mm-hmm.
In a couple of weeks, I have the feds coming to look over my payroll to make sure I'm doing that right. And for workman's comp issues. And then let's see, I have this third party audit, which is totally blowing my mind. And really, I just wanted to quit when I heard this, that, you know, Walmart expects you to have a social compliance where they force you to do an audit and then send you a bill for $3,000. So, like, it's hard for me to say, like, they're already doing all of this stuff. So why Walmart's meddling and adding this for another feather in their cap is beyond me. It just seems like a money grab and, you know, just whatever. It has nothing to do with food safety or anything. I don't know why they need to see my books or anything like that. Like, we have, you know, so as far, it's just, God, rules and regulations. Like, we've been doing all this stuff, you know, highly organized, documented manner, but that's what makes me think, I'm like, what's going on out there in the world where there's just is it just like a lucrative business to double check someone else's work? Or I'm like, you can keep bullying us. You guys are just going to be the ones that are going to suffer. I know how to grow food, you know? So it's like, I don't fully understand it.
Yeah. That is a wild thought, that you're, as a farmer, doing everything you can to, you know, grow food and get it on the shelves. Meanwhile, you have, you know, 3 different governmental, you know, potential bodies to come and talk to you about if you're doing it right, and charge you to have them come and look. Meanwhile, you're saying that Walmart, a private corporate institution, business, in order to accept the fruit that you're trying to sell them, is also, again, doubling down on more regulations of their own?
Yes, this is all on them. So, like, I do, like I said, a food safety audit that Walmart accepts,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, is bogus anyway. I mean, you know, my farm is pretty put together and well maintained, and it just I don't know, I love it. And
yeah, no, it's a gorgeous farm. I have to say, it makes sense you guys are doing well on UPIC, because it's, when you go there to go pick, it's pretty picturesque, and it's a really beautiful feeling. So yeah, I feel for you to have to face down these regulations left and right, and from people who seem to have no business even asking.
That's my biggest problem. Like, you know what? I walk in there into Walmart, I'm like, these people are, what are they hiding? Mm-hmm. Like, their employees look so happy all the time. Like what's,
yeah.
What are their regulations?
Employees are subsidized by us taxpayers, while Walmart makes hand over fist profits, you know, and not being forced to have to pay their employees what they're worth, except making us, you know, have to, you know, cover their losses and cover their costs on that, which is wild.
Well, I just feel like if they need to come in and make sure I'm paying my employees overtime, this is Walmart, Seamus. This has nothing to do with, you know, the state getting their money. I felt like, I told my broker, I'm like, this is harassment. I'm like, what? And then they're going to send me a $3,000 bill. So if I don't do this, I can't sell fruit to Walmart, which, you know, I wish there's going to come a day where I don't have to. Just because, I mean, it's just, they must have just a bunch of people locked in a room, you know, just having, like, if they don't come up with a sheet of nonsense every day, then they're fired. I don't know what it is, but
mm-hmm.
the fact is they take a lot of fruit, and they are extremely picky about their fruit. I've had a whole entire load of Macintosh go all the way down to Florida that I knew were absolute, just some of the nicest Macintosh I've ever had. And they got rejected for not enough color. I said, that's impossible. So the broker's like, well, what do you want me to do? Do you want them back? You're going to have to pay the trucking. I was like, yes. Tell the truck driver to drive them back. I'm not letting Walmart, you know, like either they overordered or they want to backdoor them to a market down in Florida and sell them. I don't really know. I got them back here. I had them inspected. There was the inspector couldn't find anything wrong with them. So there's another $3,000 that came out of my pocket for no other reason except for the store didn't want them that day or whatever. So it makes a hard job even harder when at the end of the day, you feel like you accomplished something. And on a Sunday morning, you get a phone call that says they don't want them. They're not red enough. I'm like, you have no idea what went into getting them down there. You just have no idea. And just flick of a switch, bad mood that day, wrong inspector. And, you know, your Macintosh are coming back to you.
What can be done to help you there on the farm with, you know, questions like this? Or is there some way that either local government or even the local community or even the state might be able to not just throw you a bone, but set something up that makes sense?
You know, I mean, I don't know who to trust as far as politics go. I mean, I have had a handful of politicians down here over the years that, you know, seem to have some sort of interest in at least hearing our problems and our bitching and moaning and stuff like that. And so I know Dee Dee Barrett's been down here a lot. She's been a big advocate for us as far as at least having a voice in that local government.
I feel like these are campaign walks, you know, shake, press and flesh just to, you know, make sure they cover their bases, that they're talking to the farmers.
I don't really know, man. I don't have a good read on it. I don't, like I said, after she left, my head's back down packing apples, loading trucks. Yeah. It's just like, okay, thanks for meeting with us, but I got to go.
Sure.
Because in my mind, I'm like, this is, you know, show face. But then, I mean, I try not to be that cynical. I'm like, you know what? Maybe they're going to go back and open some eyes. Maybe they have a bill that they want to put their name on. Like, Gillibrand was down here for a long time before she got promoted or, you know, got a higher position in government, but used to get Christmas cards from her. So it was like, you know, a more intimate, at least head in there that can talk on a podium. But as far as anything changing, I don't think anything's going to change as fast as, you know, just the economy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's only so much shelf space for apples is what I'm saying. And you have places like Washington State this year who had an absolute ridiculous record crop. We're going to be dealing with Washington State apples like next September. Uh-huh. They're still going to be pulling them out of CA and flooding the market with them. That was them in Michigan this year, like, killed us. So, you know, it wasn't a horrible thing that, you know, half my farm was totaled out because I'd be sitting here with half a cooler full of fresh fruit that's going bad by the day. It's funny how things work. But as far as apples are concerned, I think the market is just, it's max capacity. There's apples coming out of our ears in this country. So, and people don't seem to be interested in not planting anymore. Closer together, more yield per acre, all that good stuff.
So have you been hearing anything? Is there any talk amongst you and the other farming communities with, you know, thoughts on the term regenerative ag these days? Is that something that comes up?
I hear from some smaller venues, smaller guys that are trying to experiment with that.
Mm-hmm.
We try to keep animals out of our orchard as we can. Because everything's delicious, you know. So I mean, yeah. As far as tree fruit grows, I don't know how easy. I personally have not looked into that. Because you know, everything's up off the ground. You need your weed strip there, and So not much from what I've heard. It's pretty much mostly commercial stuff trying to, you know, utilize maybe equipment to take over a lot of hand jobs.
Yeah.
You know, as far as either pruning or picking or like even this year, we threw together this tractor air compressor, threw 100 feet worth of hose on it. And like just me and my dad out there in these certain smaller blocks, we're absolutely killing it. I mean, me and my 66 year old father just out there trimming acres of trees a day. It's crazy.
Wow.
But yeah, I don't, as far as like, you know, are you talking about like trying to grow something underneath the apple trees to
That's an idea. I mean, the other things like, I don't know if you have so much loss of land to ravines or erosion issues going on, but planting along streamlines and increasing hedgerow size to accommodate a little bit more biodiversity and maybe more of a windbreak.
That's, however, though, what you just described, that's very common. That's actually in our mission statement, business plan there or whatever. It's actually a whole entire section in Global Gap is like, you know, what do you do to prevent erosion? And so, you know, we plant grass in the rows. We keep our culverts open. We have hedgerows planted or not planted, but we haven't taken them out for very specific reasons. Mostly with this family, it's too rocky, you know, so just keep the cedar trees there to, like you said, house some bees at least. And
yeah,
windbreak for sure.
It's an interesting question because I am, you know, when we spoke with Britt Terry, you know, who is Natural Roots in Conway, Massachusetts, they're growing in the middle of a floodplain right on the South River, which puts them in a position where if you get a 100-year, you know, rainstorm, 100-year flood, they had 100% crop loss last year because of, you know, the July rains. At the same time, I can't even imagine how much worse it would have been if they didn't have the whole, you know, upland of old growth forest and you know, all of the added roots in the ground that they have around them already. I mean, if that wasn't there, they probably could never farm there again. So I know that there is creeping in the conversation around farming practices of planting this and that. I mean, I know you can't, at least in New York State, grow fruit trees commercially without spraying for everything, for insect pests and that sort of thing. But I know that there are some people that are trying to talk about, well, if you diversify the species, you know, from row to row, or diversify having more, I don't know, there's some really wacky farmers out there who are doing really weird things like locust trees in with your, you know, with multiple different crops growing in the same row, kind of adding diversity to kind of, you know, increase pest controlling populations like birds and other bugs that would come in. It sounds like, I mean, it seems like a nice dream and could be applicable in, you know, hand-tended garden type orchards. But when you're growing at the scale of dozens to hundreds of acres, how feasible is that really?
It's just like this, I don't know if you heard of like the brown marmorated stink bug that's kind of invaded a handful of years ago. They don't live in the orchards. They live 50 feet into the woods and come into the orchards to you know, eat the apples. Mm-hmm. In the fall, there's other pests that are coming, like the spotted lantern fly, maybe.
Yeah, I met that for the first time recently, actually. Yeah,
they love, is it the tree of heaven, I think it's called?
That's where they nest on.
So I mean, it's something like that. Like if you have a very specific pest that, you know, is going to consume trees, maybe plant those on your hedgerows or something. But for me, I mean, you've seen my farm, it is wide open, surrounded mm-hmm. by woods. So, you know, if it's not deer, it's rabbits or turkeys or microscopic mites to, you know, we try and do our best, like, especially if we're in a window, you know, let the ladybugs and the praying mantis and all the other stuff that like organically eats all those nasty critters, you know, mm-hmm. let them do their thing and clean up the aphids and.
So you have that timed in with your spraying timing and stuff? Like you consider that when you are doing your calendar?
Yeah. I mean, we're not going to miss one if there's like a growth window. Like in the spring, it's different. You got to spray every week, mostly for your powdery mildews and your scab and all those normal things that if you miss one during a wedding period, you're done for the year. You're done. It's not going back. You can't fix it. Mm-hmm. You miss a spray by 2 days with a fungicide, especially, then you're dealing with unmarketable fruit. And unfortunately, you know, everything's got to be bright and shiny and
so Walmart
look great
says.
In the store. Yeah. Well, they seem to be one of the most picky. Trust me. I'm the last one that wants to pay $250,000 spray bill at the end of the year. You know, I would much rather keep that and figure out, you know, have some spots on the apples. Or something, you know. But.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's great to hear it from the farmer's mouth, you know, and to really understand like what it does come down, like why aren't the farmers doing this? Like a lot of times it seems, you know, on the larger, the bigger conversation that the blame lands on your shoulders when your hands are pretty much tied, you know, from doing the work to having to pay for it, to having to get it to market, to having to deal with people who won't carry it for ridiculous reasons. And then will also apparently charge you to inspect it for them when you already have government inspectors doing all the same work. It's wild to me. And it's wild to me that people don't have a better understanding of the real plight that farmers are facing, you know, not just to do the damn work and get it to market, but then in the face of things failing because of the changing climate and all the craziness that comes with that. So hats off to you for going into it and or being in it and keeping it going. What do you think the future of farming in New York will be, you know, from your position?
Truthfully?
Sure.
Obsolete.
Wow. Why?
You got 6 more years until the 40-hour overtime is fully in place. So this year it's down to 56. Next year it's 52, 48, 44, 40. So that means during my peak time, yeah, I told you about this 5-month span where I have zero income, mm-hmm. but I'm still filling up tractors with diesel fuel, spray materials, you know, tens of thousands of dollars worth of trees I'm going to plant. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of overhead before I make a dime, and that's hoping everything goes great.
Yeah.
Once we get to, you know, 2030-ish, who knows what's going to be with, you know, especially in this state, the wacky ideas, the brilliant ideas that they come out with once in a while, like you can't do this, can't do that for no apparent reason. It's just a blank, and they're all blanket rules. What bothers me is there's no specifics. There's no like, well, he's a tree farmer, so you know he can do this a little different. He's a spinach farmer; he can do that a little different. He's this guy's whatever.
Yeah,
I don't know what's going to happen. It's not about staying afloat. It's about, like, you know, making some money and expanding, and you know, having better ideas than just sitting in this. You know, when you get to 40 hours of mandatory overtime, A, it's going to kill the farmers. B, it's gonna detract any migrant workers that want to come to New York for any reason to try and make any money, because there's not gonna be anybody. They're gonna like, I'm already at a position where 6 years out, I'm like, all right, how do I switch this up so I'm not paying 70 people 18 hours of overtime every single week, and my payroll is already over $1 million. You know, you add that in, that's $2 million, and then all of a sudden, it just cost me $100,000 to farm that year. You know, like, so at what point do, you know, families in my position, farmers in my position, people that do this, you know, in and out, and I'm not going to say thanklessly, because, you know, there's quite a lot of people that appreciate, you see that from your pick your own, you know, it's just, people are just like, I can't thank you. Put it this way, farming might not be obsolete, but small family farms will be obsolete. There's no, I can't see any way they're going to survive, even at the level that I'm at. When you're just forced to, you know, it's a, listen, we always pay our workers great. We treat them great. They live here for free. We pay for them to get here. We pay for them to get home. Literally, if they want to come here and work, all they got to do is come and work and pay for food and send all the money that they make back home or do whatever they want with it, you know? So yeah, once people like me start strategizing, all right, well, I guess I got to downgrade. So, you know, all of my profits aren't going to overtime payments. It's just going to deter help coming to New York. So small family farms are in trouble. And then the only farms that I can foresee being left are ones that are run by, you know, major big businesses. You know, it's going to be a business, like kind of what you see in California. And so, yeah, that's scary. And it's going to be here before I know it.
So the monopolization and conglomeration of farming is going to kill farming in New York State faster than climate change will, it sounds like.
Oh, hell yeah. Definitely. Listen, I'm acknowledging climate change at this point, because I'm like, you know, like I said, you got to lift your head up once in a while and see what's going on around you. And it's undeniable. It's something's not right. It's not the same.
Where can people find you? How can people, you know, help out? I guess your UPIC opens up in June.
Oh, yeah. Well, as far as like, yeah, physically coming to the farm, end of June is sweet cherries. 4th of July weekend's normally sours. Middle of July is black sour cherries, which is probably my most popular pick your own item. Mm-hmm. And beginning of August, middle of August is peaches. And then second week in September is pick your own apples.
Great. And that's Fix Brothers Farm outside of Hudson, New York. Any last words, any other thoughts you want to throw out there before? they find you?
No, I don't know. I didn't really know what to expect from our conversation, but it's pretty much the things I think on a daily basis. It's just getting harder, and you know, body is sore, still getting up, doing the grind. And I don't mind it so much if I know it's going to be worth it here in the future. Everything is so uncertain, and it's tough to really invest or make big moves based on anything, climate change, whatever. We do what we can. We're pretty resourceful. We're pretty quick, pretty, you know, if we want to get something done, we get it done. But
yeah,
hopefully there's some relief in some of this. I mean, just everybody's figured out how to make a business on farmers. It's crazy.
And it doesn't sound like too many people are coming out with an open hand looking to, you know, give you a leg up.
Till the end, I'm going to do my best, grow the best quality fruit I can and stay afloat as long as I can. And like I said, but there's a strategy meeting on the horizon here for sure.
Well, thank you for doing the good work on that. And I hope that we can find some common ground for you as soon as possible, because we need farmers. We need people who are doing the good work of growing the food that we need to eat. And thank you. Thank you again for coming out. Is there any way you want to, you know, make yourself available for people to reach out to you, like a Instagram handle or an email address or website?
I do not have Instagram.
Cool.
They can go to fixbrothersfruitfarm.com, which I think Fix Brothers has an Instagram. I personally don't, but there should be a link to Instagram on that website. Yeah. And that website also, you know, will send you alerts, dates, picking dates. Sure. And this year it was the case of non-picking dates, and we're sorry, but you know, all the updates.
Okay. Very good. Well, thanks again for coming on. I appreciate, you know, hearing it from the farmer's mouth for sure. And, I know it's a little stream of consciousness, but we love that. Thank you very much.
It's been a while, Seamus. You've been trying to get me on for a while. I finally did it.
I'm glad you made it. And you're welcome back anytime you have something you want to get off your chest.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to reach out with any comments or questions, feel free to email us at ourcommonnaturepodcast@gmail.com or follow us on Instagram at our.common.nature.